Education and General Government Committee, and I'd like to start with a opening of a public hearing on Senate Bill 443. We have Senator Cruz and Representative Roblin here. If you guys wanted to kick things off, I know Representative Roblin, you have your own committee to administer, and we'll try to get you out of here.
Thank you, Chair Haas, and the rest of the committee. My name is, for the record, is Arnie Roblin. I'm representative from District 9, and I am pleased to be sitting here with a colleague who we have worked a lot on education. It's been interesting that Senator Cruz and I have ended up on a number of different groups together working on things and have some fairly common interests with respect to making sure that all Oregon children have the best education they can possibly have. And part of that has to do with Senate Bill 443. We have had a group working for a number of years with the ESDs who have been looking at issues around staff development, around technology. This bill really makes that group more official. It also starts getting at what I think is one of the things that our state needs to improve on the most, and that is how do we make sure that every district in this state can learn from every other district in this state, and we can start having staff development at the local levels, which makes that teacher in every classroom the best they can possibly be. I think if you were out on the steps earlier today, you saw the Stand for Children people talking about the fact that that first most important person in the life of a child in education is their parent. The next person is the teacher. And the way you make exceptional teachers is to make sure that you have exceptional staff development. And we have, all of those of us who have been in education, have found those programs that were amazing and did, in fact, raise the level of your art and craft of teaching. And we've also seen many dollars spent on activities that did not work. And that money was spent. A few may have got something out of it, but to change your whole school and the culture and the opportunities for each kid, it wasn't realized. This is the beginning of having that one place where districts can go and look and find practices that have been used around the state that have improved, whether it was math instruction, whether it was English instruction. It gives people a chance and other people within the industry to go talk to about how it worked in their district. We have to continue to get better and wiser at spending the dollars that we have. And staff development is one of those places where a wise investment leads to better education for every Oregon child. And I encourage you to ask questions, find out answers from people. The ESDs have done, I think, an exceptional job in bringing together people over the last few years around technology and other issues. This allows that group with a few extra people to formally start working on things like staff development. So any questions, I would love to hear them. And if you would like to hear from my colleague, it would be great.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. We've had several meetings over the interim driving towards this objective, and it's a good objective to actually have a menu of options for teachers to be able to access to further their development or to work on areas of need. Teaching is like most other professions. A great deal of the education you get in teaching is what you get once you're out teaching and you're doing continuing ed. It's the same for doctors, nurses, even farmers. Trust me on that one. And so this is very positive. I think this is a great step in formalizing our ability to move forward with this. Talking to Representative Roblin in the back, I think the only addition I might suggest to the bill would be that we add some legislators as ex officio to the group officially, because I think that that helps keep the focus and the drive and to ensure that this group understands our continued and committed interest in the subject. So that would be something I might suggest as an ad, but to continue the work we have already started and hopefully to move forward. And quite honestly, this is something we can do without necessarily putting a whole lot of new resources into the process. So this isn't creating a, this is something kind of new, but it's kind of reformalizing something that already exists. It's hopefully not a big revenue impact. And I think something that's absolutely essential, a lot of the things we started last session, the mentoring program and different things like that are all absolutely critical. Our ability to expand those efforts is going to be difficult in this environment, but this is one I think we can move forward on, and so we have the opportunity to give teachers more and better tools to help them do a better job of what they have chosen as a career to do, because teaching is what's in their heart, and if we can give them tools to allow them to reach their kids better, then it's a win for everybody.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry if you covered this while I was late. Forgive me. Representative Roblin, Senator Cruz, thank you so much for your work on this. I absolutely applaud your efforts and your commitment to education. And I think this Education Enterprise Steering Commission is great. And the way I'm reading the bill, there's no fiscal impact with that particular part of the bill. And the cost of the bill is in the website. And I have to, even though $300,000 is a drop in the bucket in what we're talking about overall here in the state, I have to wonder, is there some website somewhere now for less than $300,000 that could have this calendar and this information?
And I think that once the organization gets set up, and what you have here is, there'll be some people that follow us that can probably answer that question more specifically with respect to the total cost. I think when you start writing these, you start saying, if we had to develop the whole thing, what's it going to cost us? You get a number. When you push on what can we do and are there places that we could have host and do some other things, you might find some of those things can go away. I think you have to clearly understand that is the value of the thing once it gets going. It has some value that is there. In the days that we have today, with the constraints that we have, I'm sure that everyone who's associated with this will work in any way they can with you to figure out how to make those numbers less. The part that's hard for me to explain, I had the opportunity when I was a high school principal to work with a group through Confederated Oregon School Administrators and the Department of Ed on bringing some of the best and most knowledgeable educated people from universities to this state to put on workshops. And the experience changed my life with respect to understanding how important staff development can be. The problem with some of our small schools, they never know what those things are out there or when they're here. And when you, if you can't figure a way to share so that somebody knows that this person is coming and it's the information we really need to have, and they're going to be only a little ways away. You know, to keep them for another day might make this something that we could afford. Are lost opportunities that never come around again. And so, you know, I know that it's going to cost something. They'll talk to you about how much per student that really is. It's not very much money. In the long run, the benefits you get are so much greater. And I hope that as you talk to people, we work at that, there may be other ways to cut the price down.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm Senator Bonamici. I'd also submit that as valuable as this resource is going to be, there may be the potential of other fund sources to help with this.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, thank you, gentlemen. We'll let you represent it. Senator Morris.
Thank you. I do have some questions. Thank you for coming today. It's my understanding we do have an existing Education Enterprise Steering Committee. Can you distinguish what that committee has done, its charter, versus what this commission would do with the same name?
If you talk, there's some people behind us who will be answer that question, because I've sat in a number of these meetings, and I'm not sure exactly all of the things that they have done before. The thing that I think came across the greatest when we had those conversations is that they started the conversations, whether it was around technology or other issues with respect to higher ed and K-12 and the ESDs, and how do we make our region work together to pool our monies to get the best dollar, best materials for the dollar. And that as they started doing it, got its own synergy, and more things came to this group, and the people who were in the collaboration saw the greater and greater values, and it became more and more important to them to keep having this conversation. When we started having the group get together, it turned out that we were inviting the same people, though they were not doing the whole state, they were just doing a regional part. We were inviting the same people who were already on this, and it became clear to us that, you know, with by changing the vision a little bit about a statewide influence, the expertise that has already been developed can be shared with all the rest of the schools, and hopefully we'll even get a bigger synergy with regard to the values we can add to all of our school districts. So they could probably explain a little bit clearly, more clearly, all that they have done before, but there are some people here that could explain that better than I.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, to a degree this is a replacement, and it's taking the work that has already taken place, and the vision for what we came up with for this web-based system and what we think will end up being an incredible resource. Excuse me, and putting it in a more formalized setting so it can, the development can have more rigor and actually probably achieve the objective in a much more comprehensive way. So I don't envision the group that has existed continuing. It won't be necessary anymore. This replaces it.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. As I recall, Lynn Benton Lincoln Education Service District had a website that was exceptionally well developed with respect to curriculum resources, assistance for teachers. Do you know what the status of that? And I apologize, it's in my district, so I should know, but I'm wondering if there's something that's already created that could substitute for this big fiscal.
I would hope that, again, people who are going to follow us could answer that question, because I don't know that particular one as well. But I would expect they may have an answer for you on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, to a degree, that there's other resources that are out there and existing and other districts that have done a lot of work in this area. I guess the main goal is to consolidate all of the good things that exist into one place that's accessible to all. And so I don't think we're necessarily replacing, but all the good work that currently exists certainly would be included in all this. So, but if you're going to create a statewide system, and I don't know technology all that well, but I would assume it's more complicated than setting up an email address. So, and I don't even know how to do that. So,
okay, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James Sager. You have a panel. Kate Dixon. Courtney Vanderstead. David Williams. And Maureen Casey.
I will start from this position. I'm always at the knees of these women. I'm just begging them to help. For the record, James Sager with the Governor's Office. Very quickly, if I might, I just wanted to highlight the main components of the bill, and then I'm going to turn it over to my three colleagues here and Dave Williams behind me, who will articulate and cover many of the questions that you have you've asked. We also have passed out for you the list of all the different organizations that participated on this work group. Decided not to give you all the individual names because the size of the people who came and the email list that we were keeping people informed with was quite large, so I figured you'd at least want to know who was on. And you also have the national standards that will be mentioned here, as well as a survey document. Briefly, the bill, Section 1, lays out the membership of the commission. Section 2, the terms of serving on there. 3, the purpose, and the three primary areas are this interactive website that you've already mentioned, helping with the professional development, providing a statewide focus and coordination, and then also education technology. As the last section has to do with the cost, which amounts to just shy of 24 cents per weighted ADM per year. So it is not much of a cost, but we feel that the leverage that will be quite significant. So with that, I would like to turn it over to first Courtney, and then we'll work across.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Courtney Vandersteck. I'm the Assistant Executive Director for the Oregon Education Association. And my little piece of the OEA pie, I guess, is our Center for Teaching and Learning. So professional development for our members, both our K-12 teachers, our community college faculty, as well as our classified members, is very high on my list. OEA worked with the Chalkboard Foundation to create this professional development survey that you all have received copies of also. We all know that there's a great deal of research that shows that professional learning can have a powerful effect on teacher skills and knowledge, and therefore on student learning. And we also know that providing sustained quality professional learning opportunities becomes a greater challenge in times of declining resources. Oftentimes, professional development dollars are among the first to get cut from district budgets, and we all certainly understand why that can happen, and the financial times that we're facing are certainly critical. But the value and the impact of high-quality professional development on student learning and student achievement is just, it's too critical to lose sight of that, even in really tough financial times. Through the survey, teachers in Oregon identify professional development that helps them be more effective with struggling students, in closing the achievement gaps, in assisting students with special needs, and also in evaluating their own work as professionals and figuring out how to do things better. It also identified that teachers value collaborative, hands-on professional development focused on important content. What OEA believes that this Senate bill does is it gives us the opportunity to begin creating a system that would increase access and information about high-quality professional learning offerings for all educators, not only our classroom teachers, but all educators. And it gives districts a way to bridge the gap between what they want to be able to offer educators and what they can afford to offer. We have several places around this state that do a tremendous job of providing professional learning opportunities for their educational employees. But it is, I call it sometimes random acts. We don't have the ability to share that wealth of knowledge across the state for both our larger and smaller and most rural educators, and it's a need around the state. So this helps us put a system in place to do that, and that's why the Oregon Education Association has worked as a partner in creating the legislation and supports it so that we can create a structure that promotes a bottom-up approach for the application of professional development, and we would urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Courtney. And for the record, I'm Kate Dixon. I'm interim president of the Chalkboard Project. And also, just to give you a little background, I've spent my career as an educator. I was a teacher and principal in the Salem-Keizer School District for a number of years. I was the assistant superintendent in the Westland Wilsonville School District. I was the assistant executive director of COSA for about 7 years, and deputy superintendent of public instruction for several years. I say all that to provide you context for my remarks, not just to brag about how old I may be, so I caution you about that. But we really do appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts with you today about Senate Bill 443. And it is a key priority bill for Chalkboard. This bill represents nearly four years of research emphasizing research on best practices that Oregon can invest in to improve student achievement. We've touched about 100,000 citizens in our work over the past few years. We've talked with teachers, we've talked with school board members, we've talked with students, administrators, parents, representatives of the majority of Oregonians who do not have children in school. We believe we've done our homework, and with our colleagues, we are presenting a strategy that we believe will maximize educator quality and that will support increasing student achievement. As you know, high-quality teachers have a greater impact on student achievement than any other variable affecting student achievement. With that in mind, we also know that the state has a responsibility as a major funder of Oregon schools to direct its investments in strategic ways and to measure those results of those investments while giving local school districts flexibility to meet their unique student achievement challenges. Based on that, we believe that Senate Bill 443 proposes an innovative, bold approach to strengthening Oregon educators to maximize student achievement results. We must develop the best educators possible in Oregon schools by providing a systemic approach to professional development for all educators, ensuring quality learning options for all school employees. Senate Bill 443 addresses the fact that Oregon is one is of only a few states with no statewide educator support system to ensure high-quality professional development. Oregon currently spends more than $100 million a year for professional development, and those are expenses that are well worth it. That's across the state, and that supports over 37,000 educators. But within that context, we lack a systemic support system to provide information and access to high-quality professional development. We can't continue to leave the quality and relevancy of ongoing professional support for Oregon school employees up to chance. In a recent Chalkboard survey, 90% of Oregonians surveyed believe teachers should receive ongoing professional training. I thought that was pretty remarkable that citizens across the state of Oregon are quite attuned to this issue. And 86% agree that attracting and retaining highly qualified teachers is the key to accelerating learning and teaching. We also have national research that shows that teacher effectiveness is the greatest single factor influencing gains in student achievement. There's also a national researcher, Robert Marzano, who indicates that when professional development for educators is focused on the most effective or needed instructional practices, student achievement can increase by as much as 20%. Courtney shared with you results from our survey to Oregon teachers, and I would just add a couple of comments. Almost 90% of the survey respondents said they participated in professional development to gain knowledge of skills to apply to their classrooms and or to gain awareness and acquire new knowledge. We have educators across Oregon that are hungry to be do their best and to be on a continuous learning curve. 75% or more agreed that as a result of their professional development, they implemented what they learned, their students benefited, and they shared what they had learned. Over 7 in 10 similarly reported that they had gained valuable information and knowledge, their practice had improved, and that they taught better. Teachers are motivated by their desire to gain knowledge and skills that translate to the classroom. So based on that, Senate Bill 443 establishes a web-based learning network to provide an infrastructure for standards-based professional development for all Oregon school employees, teachers, administrators, and classified employees. It's important to note that we are not proposing a large new bureaucracy. We are not extending to a new big state agency with bricks and mortar. We are also not proposing a new regulatory agency. What we are creating is a K-12 or K-20 commission with a mission and a responsibility to coordinate effective professional development for new and experienced Oregon teachers, administrators, and classified employees. This is an opportunity for Oregon educators to work as a connected team to support each other professionally and make sure they're getting the tools they need to help students succeed. Our vision is to create a professional, interactive, web-based learning network. We would use existing infrastructure to maximize resources and focus on making sure the professional development information and access is aligned with the new standards for high-quality professional development. One aspect of the bill has already been accomplished. The State Board in December took action and endorsed the National Staff Development Counselors for High-Quality Professional Development. So we now have a framework for what do we mean by high-quality professional development. The primary objective of the Commission's Professional Development Clearinghouse will be to develop and oversee the statewide learning network, integrate the quality standards based on national standards, provide quality assurance for professional development providers, and advance research-based best practices for increasing student achievement. So what is Chalkboard's commitment to the success of this new professional development clearinghouse? As a representative of the private nonprofit sector, we believe that we can help. We believe that this process is value-added by including business and nonprofit support. Chalkboard will provide ongoing support for the professional development learning network by providing emerging research and best practices information, by supporting the ongoing piloting of education best practices that increase student achievement, and by supporting the ongoing learning network by raising funds through business partnerships and grants. One example of that is that on Oregon's birthday, this past Saturday, we launched a mentoring website for the mentoring program in Oregon. We did that in partnership with the Oregon Department of Education and Boeing, and they stepped up and helped us fund a mentoring website. It is not nearly the advanced website that we're proposing here, but it's at least an initial website that will support the mentoring program that you passed last legislative session. And we're very excited about that. So last but not least, Chalkboard is funded by the six of the largest foundations in Oregon, Meyer Memorial Trust, the Collins Foundation, the Ford Family Foundation, Gerald Wen Foundation, James F. and Marion Miller Foundation, and the Oregon Community Foundation, along with more than 20 Oregon foundations and businesses. We all want the best education possible for Oregon's 565,000 public school children. To assure 21st century teaching and learning, we must invest in our Oregon public school employees. The districts and schools need to have resources at their fingertips to be better prepared to teach our ever-increasing diverse student population. We want all of our children to read at grade level by grade 3. We want them to meet academic benchmarks each year, and we want them to graduate prepared for college, work, and life. Thank you for your thoughtful considerations.
Thank you. Chris, you have a...
I do. Chair Hass, members of the committee, I'm Maureen Casey, and I'm the superintendent of Willamette Education Service District, and I'm also currently serving as an ad hoc member on the Educational Enterprise Steering Committee. We feel that this bill is really consistent with the state's agenda, and it actually formalizes a process that we've piloted over the last 2 years. And because we've piloted it, I've got some outcomes to share with you. And we can say with conviction that it really is starting to make a difference. And if ever there was a time where we needed collaborative statewide leadership, it's definitely now. And the steering committee concept came from research. And research tells us if you are going to have true systems change, you get that by building capacity when you invest in collaborative efforts of all the stakeholders. And that's what the steering committee did. And the states a couple years ago brought in the Annenberg Foundation and conducted a study. And this is one of the recommendations that they put forth. Fullen also tells us you have to look at tri-level institution of change if you're really going to have systemic, sustainable change. So ESDs and the State Department of Education, after the Annenberg study, began bringing together on a monthly basis all those stakeholders that you've heard about. K-12 district SUPs, ESD superintendents, representatives from ODE, technology, school improvement, special education, represented from the governor's office, OUS, and community colleges. There we are, all in the same room. We are not having conversations in isolation. So every sector talks about a particular situation or a challenge from their perspective. We learn from each other. We share. Must be something like partisanship, I think. So this steering committee represents the educational enterprise, the whole enterprise, pre-K to post-secondary. It provides the structure that we think we need for true leadership. We have two staff currently who do the work, one in the area of school improvement, one in the area of technology. Where does that money come from? ESDs have been paying for 50% of those costs, and the State Department of Education have been paying for 50% of those costs. This is a way to motivate the stakeholders to invest the energy to get results. So what have we accomplished to date? Started out in terms of regional professional development opportunities, started out with accountability, data-driven decision-making, and who did we start with? Leadership. Superintendents, principals. Isn't that novel? Get buy-in. There were 819 participants across the state. ESDs offered these workshops. 819 participants. Then we rolled it out to districts. The first strand that dealt with data collection, analysis, interpretation, professional development teams, learning communities. 61 districts across the state participated and received follow-up support. That workshop was followed by what we call strand two. 93 districts to date have participated, and several more of that strand is planned for between now and the end of the school year. It's using data to improve learning. There was a gentleman named Cole who wrote a paper that he called it Professional Development, a Great Way to Avoid Change. And the point that he was making was that people spend too much time going off to workshops out of state, out of district. They come back. There's nobody else who had the workshop. They're kind of excited about some of the things that they learned, but their interest wanes. They don't implement. What they went away to learn doesn't get implemented in the classroom. This kind of planning, when it happens at this level, it is systemic, it is planful, it is organized. One follows the other. It's not just a workshop. After the workshop, follow-up coaching occurs on-site, job-embedded, very practical, with communities of educators within a particular building, not just a district, within a building. In these trainings, you've got the superintendent, the principal, and the teachers, all in listening to the same information, teaming up, deciding how they're going to go back and implement it in their districts. So you've got support, ongoing support, you have sustainability, you've just increased the probability that it's going to be successful and long-lasting. So we even provided a training of trainer models. Districts are spending thousands of dollars sending people out of state to these incredible school improvement centers to get certified so that they can provide these workshops. ESDs and district school improvement people, we, through these trainings over time, have gotten their own certification. So we're offering the workshops from our network, saving districts money and travel expenses. So in the area of technology, we really have been able to leverage some public-private partnerships which have paid off. There have been some strategic grants that we've been able to look at last-mile connectivity. You can have all the computers in the world, but if you don't have a pipeline going to your rural school that you can video stream through, it doesn't make any difference. You can't have access to what's available in technology. ESDs did a study. We identified schools throughout the state that have an issue with that last mile connectivity. We prioritize them, we leverage some funding, and grants are going out to them to bring fibers into those schools. That's pretty significant. We've identified some common tech priorities, and if the stimulus package money, when the stimulus package money comes, there are some studies that can come forward to say here are some priorities statewide that would really leverage some resources. We've discussed online coursework issues, not only from the K-12 perspective, but we've talked about how higher ed can help with that, and we've talked about specific issues related to instructional technology. So What we know is for professional development to have a real impact, it has to be job-embedded, on-site, continuous, sustainable. We feel that the system that's been put together by the steering committee and has an investment from all of those stakeholders has the strongest possibility of really making a change in this state. The steering committee presents to you a system change mechanism that will continue to build the capacity by investing in the collaborative efforts of all the stakeholders. We're just now getting traction, and we hope that you will ensure through this bill that it will continue to be part of the effort to move us forward. We thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams? Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could be brief, maybe take us back up to 30,000 foot here. I think I'm the anchor of this illustrious panel. pretty compelling testimony about need and what this page and a half of legislation will do, maybe achieve world peace in the end. I don't know. But I want to start off here just a little bit and say when we started down this work group path, we at OSBA held some core beliefs, and we still do. You know, we don't support centralization of professional development. We don't support endorsing a single provider for professional development. And we don't support removing a local district's ability to choose the appropriate professional development for their district. But what we do believe in and what we think that this bill does is it provides support in giving school districts access to high-quality professional development that's been peer-vetted and proven to achieve results. This type of clearinghouse, as we believe strongly, is that great professional development is being delivered statewide every year by local districts, by ESDs, by private, nonprofit, et cetera, providers, and that Senate Bill 443 is a great way to channel those efforts and bring them all together so that local school districts have an ability to find the right tool to fit their needs in enhancing their workforce in their district, and that really is the core of this piece of legislation, and we're just happy that you took the time to hear the bill. Thank you.
And thank you. And for the record, that was David Williams in charge of world peace.
I thought it would create world peace.
Questions of the panel? Senator Morris?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We're spending a lot of money today on in-service training, professional development, and those kinds of things. Do any of you know what that number is on a biennium basis? I have a number in the back of my mind. I don't know whether it's accurate, but it's a very large number.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I don't off the top of my head, and I know that I'm sure that probably we can pull this room and get about six or seven different numbers. I'm happy to do some research and see if we can get some hard numbers maybe from ODE about that based on the database initiative and uniform chart of accounts, but I don't have a specific number.
I have a number from 2005-2006 that was generated by John Tapania at Eco Northwest, and he worked with Brian Reeder from the Oregon Department of Ed. And at that time, they looked at the staff development code function, and it's 2240, and it's in part of the chart of accounts. And at that time, we spent $70,781,000 for that year. So, and that's annually. And then there's some other costs that probably continue to go into professional development. So it is a really big number. There are an awful lot of folks served by that number, and it is an investment, but it's no small matter. And that's why, if I'll put my pitch in, for a very small amount of money, we can begin to communicate and leverage the investment that districts are making across the state so other people can share in that knowledge.
So follow up.
Follow up.
It's my understanding that there has been some feedback with respect to the value of the training, and my understanding is that in some quarters the value of that training has been in question.
Senator Morris, members of the committee, Chair Haas, you will note in the survey that Chalkboard and OEA partnered in, there are folks that will comment that some of their training has not been the best and that there are conditions that cause that professional development training to be more appropriate and long-lasting. And one of the areas that we found in this study was that when the professional development was targeted in a teacher's subject area, it was more likely to be implemented. It was more likely to increase student achievement. We also know that if it's professional development that lasts over time, one of the things that we used to talk about professional development is like drive-by, meaning there was just one shot and one size fits all. And what we've learned, either through our research or national research, is that that is not effective professional development. And I'll just say that that's part of what we're hoping to bring together under Senate Bill 443, is that there will be standards for professional development so that whether you're doing it as a school or a district or a region area, that there will be a framework of quality standards that you will commit to before using those precious resources for professional development.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I don't want to occupy the committee here, but I do have some questions. It would seem to me that the requirements for the commission are lacking with respect to really focusing on what are the best practices to begin to narrow it down. If we're spending $140 million per biennium, that's a huge sum of money, that focusing on what really works should be a charge of this commission, and I don't see that in the language. The second issue is that in the environment that we find ourselves in, is it possible to think in terms of redirecting what we're already spending and some of it less efficiently and of less value, at least for some members, so that we think in terms of redirecting existing allocations for this professional development instead of asking for an additional $400,000 to get this thing going, because in this environment, I just don't see that happening.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, a little bit tangential or at least informative to your point, I believe a vast majority of those costs for the $70 million or $140 million a biennium is staff time. A professional development day, we're paying for the staff time that day. It's not that we're spending $140 million on instructors to come in and provide that professional development. So the vast majority are contracted days for professional development that staff person attends.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Morris asked the question that I was going to ask perhaps in a better way, because mine was going to be really long. I did want to follow up on it, though, because when I'm looking through the text of the charge for the commission, it seems very administrative. Maintain a website, coordinate professional development, display a calendar. And the general charge is very broad, statewide collaborative leadership in the areas of school improvement and technology. So to follow up on Senator Morris's question, where is that analysis? Who does that and at what stage about what really works? Because, for example, as I look through the survey, I question why the least valuable professional development is in the area of TAG. So where does that question, for example, get addressed in this process? Is it part of collaborative leadership, or is it part of the what look like administrative duties in setting up this website?
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, sorry. What we're hoping from the creation of this website is that, again, the greatest knowledge and learning comes from the sharing, so that we don't have districts thinking that they're buying a product and utilizing their money as well and finding out that, my gosh, it didn't work. So part of this website is to create that sharing opportunity where if my district has taken on an effort and it's been successful, I'm able to not only say that we did XYZ professional development, but here are the outcomes that we received from that work. Or, on the other hand, you know, it didn't work in my school, and here are the things that we've kind of looked at that didn't make sense, and now you can begin to have this sharing across districts so that you are able to make a more informed decision and understand how to pull these things together. So the charge of the commission is not to be
the approval police force for professional development. Like Dave said, we want school districts to still be able to identify what they need for their staff and their students. But it's through this collaboration, this exchanging of ideas, having the national standards now recognized in the state of Oregon, and having the commission helping to help districts use that criteria for evaluating what they're doing, we believe is going to have a better long-term connection than for this commission or anyone else to try and kind of hard and fast lay down a set of rules.
So just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so what I'm anticipating is sort of a, if you will, an Angie's List of staff development. If you know Angie's List, it's where people post comments about why I hired this company to repair my patio and they made a mess, or I hired this company to do something, and so that the schools can go on and look and see here's what's working and here isn't. Okay.
Perfect.
That helps. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. If I could just follow up to Senator Morris and Senator Bonamici. Early on in the process, we realized that one size clearly does not fit all, and a program that could be a miserable failure in one district might be exactly what another district needed. And so we didn't want to necessarily prejudice the offerings by having an authority deem them worthy or not. And clearly, if the feedback from the people that use the programs is going to inform the next school that might want to use them. So it's a bit messy. But clearly we think it's the best approach to allow a district to inform themselves on what options they have and what they, because, you know, you can see a title of a program, but you could also be informed by the comments that come back on the utilization of it as to whether you think it might fit you or not. So I think this will allow districts to better inform themselves on their choices than just saying it's an A or it's a B. So.
Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Hass, Senator Cruz, the website that the Educational Enterprise Steering Committee currently has, they do post best practices, ideas that have come, but there's also a rating. Every single workshop that's done not only asks for a quality indicator, a rating from 1 to 5, but there's a specific question that asks the application to the classroom. How did the content of this particular workshop help you in terms of direct application to the classroom? So District B then would go and look, and if the particular one that we talked about, we started out with, that rating was 92%. If it came in at a 40%, well, no district would make the mistake of replicating that, saying we want to have that in our district. The other thing that districts have been doing after going to the workshops, they conducted a pre-evaluation of their district or their particular school about where they were, you know, in a number of indicators for staff development and school improvement, and how it tied into their utilization of data warehouse or the kids project, how it was facilitating them doing their continuous improvement plan. After the series of workshop and the on-site support, they then went back and re-rated their district. And you can see where they were before they had the training and the growth that they've made in those indicators. And that, again, is all available for other districts to take a look at and benefit from.
Thank you, panel. I have Dean Samick from George Fox signed up. Anyone else on this bill signed up to testify?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Dean, thank you for coming. Go ahead and read your name into the record and don't feel the need to read your comments
sure.
As much as highlight them.
Thank you. I'm Linda Samick. I'm Dean of the School of Education at George Fox University, and I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 443. I would just note that I've been a member of the task force that's been working on this bill since prior to the 2007 legislative session. So this is of great interest to me. I also would note that I was a member of the original educator administrator quality workforce work group with the Chalkboard Project, as are several other people in the audience today. And professional development is something that was extremely important to our committee, and We originally conceived an idea where we would have a statewide network of regional sites that would both provide professional development and also support districts as they provided professional development. I think the critical piece of that is that this was a collaboration between K-12, ESDs, community colleges, and both public and private four-year institutions. I think that that's a really critical piece that we need to highlight. All of us have resources, but we all have limited resources, and so I think working together is exceedingly important. I would note that the website isn't just a listing, so it's not just Angie's List. Go on and take a look and see what's available, but it's also an opportunity for people to converse back and forth and to share experiences and to ask questions. So as it's conceived, it would be an interactive place that you could go. Currently, Oregon has no centralized way to disseminate information, and what I'd like to do is to give you just three brief examples that I have been involved in the last probably 4 months. The first one, I spent a day during most people's Christmas break at the Department of Ed working on some professional development for teachers of mathematics around the new math standards. When we got to the end of the day, we had some incredibly good PowerPoint presentations and information to share with K-12 teachers in the state. And one of the classroom teachers who was part of that group said, "Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a place that we could post these things that everybody knew to go to look for the information about the new math standards?" And the folks from ODE who were working said, "Yeah, that would be really wonderful. We don't have the space or the resources or the time to do that kind of thing. I wish someone else would." I'd also note that George Fox is part of a grant project. We're doing a series of courses for math and science in elementary schools for teachers. We have a grant that will pay scholarship money for teachers in schools where they work with high-risk children. We've had a terrible time finding a way to disseminate the information. It's on every university's website. School districts don't go there. The project has its own website. Nobody knows about that because it's a project that is small and has not been disseminated well. So this particular project with the Education Enterprise Steering Commission would be really helpful. And finally, I'm a member of the Oregon Association of Teacher Educators, and a week from this Friday, we have a conference in Portland. Our keynote speaker is Michael Geisen, who's the National Teacher of the Year. He's a science teacher from Prineville, middle school teacher. It's a very low-cost conference. We work really hard to encourage K-12 teachers and administrators to attend, but rarely do they come because we don't have good ways to get that information out into school districts. So I think what I would like to say to you folks is that the amount of money that we're talking about here in the bigger scheme of things is not large, but the impact that it could have on our ability to both share and leverage the resources that we have in K-12, ESDs, community colleges, and both public and private higher ed could have a huge impact on the state of Oregon and our educators. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Dean, thank you very much for coming down.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All righty. I will close the public hearing on SB 443. In committee, we've got a long list of things here. I think I will. Do you want to get Senator George from next door?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, on 443, with your permission, I would like to revisit the bill a little bit, maybe the makeup of the commission to a degree, and also to see if we can identify a non-general fund funding source which might make it slightly more attractive.
Nodding heads in that direction. If we want to stand in recess for just one moment here, Senator George is the sponsor of 344. He's next door. Wants to testify. congratulate you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 344. Dana, if you could give us a staff summary.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 344 removes the requirement that county assessors and county surveyors be elected. It requires the county governing body to appoint the assessors and surveyors. It allows county charters to require otherwise, and it removes the assessors and surveyors from the recall provisions.
Senator George.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Larry George, State Senator from Senate District 13. Appreciate the chair hearing the bill. Senate Bill 344 came out of a conversation and an event that happened that brought something to my attention, which my district covers four separate counties. Washington County is a home rule county and appoints its assessor, its surveyor, and I believe its treasurer. And what they do is they go out and get the very best, very highest quality individuals. And I think Washington County even did a nationwide search for their assessor. But under current state law, those counties that are not home rule counties are required under our state statutes and in part in the Constitution to elect the sheriff, county clerk, county assessor, county treasurer, and county surveyor. In Yamhill County, where my mother, County Commissioner Kathy George, is county commissioner, they are also under term limits. And our county surveyor, who is, I believe is going to here testify on the bill, is term limited out. And one of the things that was really happened in a conversation I was having with Commissioner George is that here they have a county commissioner who was doing such an excellent job on implementation. And these positions, county assessor and county surveyor, are not policy-making positions. They are implementers. They are technical individuals who are implementing law, but they're not making policy. And here they had this great county surveyor who was, in essence, going to be term limited. And now they're going to have an election. And in Yamhill County, there's only so many people that could actually qualify under the state statutes to run. So the field of people who could possibly fill Dan's shoes would be a limited number of people, because under current state law, they have to meet certain criteria of having qualifications of a surveyor, but also live inside the county. At the same time, in a different county, a piece of property that I own with my sister and my brother, we had an assessor staff member move to disqualify our property from our farm operation as farm tax assessment. When I pointed out that they were incorrectly implementing the law, there was very little response whatsoever from the assessor's office. I couldn't understand why there was no response, and we ended up litigating the issue, and we won. The very next year, they filed the same exact effort to withdraw our property from farm tax assessment, and again, we had to go to court. When I contacted the county commissioners, their view was is that there was absolutely nothing we could do because the county assessor was elected. What happens is that there's no way, really, to build a political momentum to replace people who are implementing the law poorly, because they're not policy-making people. And so what you can have is you have two specific situations where Senate Bill 344 would help out. One is, in those counties where we have term limits, these positions that are technical positions would be appointed by the county commission. And those other situations where you have unresponsive county surveyors or county assessors, you could bring in some accountability because they would then answer to the county commissioners. In essence, we would bring some accountability so that the people could go to somebody who is responsive on the policy side. I think that the bottom line on this is that there's very few constituencies to change something that's small in government that has a vested interest or a significant interest. But the fact is that many counties could appoint a part-time assessor or a part-time surveyor by contract or have them job share on something else and not necessarily have a full-time job. It's a small, insignificant, I suppose, amount to many counties, but it would give the county commissioners a great deal more latitude and some flexibility in job descriptions. So this is basically, from my perspective, a good government bill. streamlines the process, gives more accountability to the citizens because they can go to the county commissioner, who is much more sensitive to poorly implemented law. And finally, what it'll do is we can go out and find the best and brightest for these positions. Now, think about it again. You get into smaller counties, you have a very limited pool of people who can actually apply for these positions. But if counties could go out and do a statewide or nationwide search for the best and brightest for that position, they could do so. I would point, if I could, Mr. Chair, to there are some Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 344. When it came out of legislative council, the way the amendments came, the way the bill came out, that the appointment would still be subject to the geographic limitation of the county. And I wanted to, where one of the things we're trying to get rid of is the limitation of the county that you live in. We could have very, very bright individuals in Washington County who could serve as a county surveyor in Polk or Yamhill County, but they happen to live in Washington County. And under current law, and under the way the bill was originally drafted, the person would have to live in Yamhill County. That may not be the best to serve the citizens of that county. So it would also, I think Dash 1s would be a necessary improvement if you decide to move the bill, Mr. Chair. Any questions?
I appreciate that, Senator, very much. I honestly cannot disagree with the points you raise. Any questions?
Do we have the Dash 1 amendments?
We do not have those amendments
yet. Oh, okay. My staff had them, so I will make sure that they get submitted.
I think that's a very... very valid point. You know, Washington County, my county, recently went through this and did that nationwide search. And even though there's a lot of talent in Washington County, I think they had the fortune of being able to search and find the best, most qualified people wherever they were. Okay. Well, thank you.
And I'll get the Dash 1s to you right away.
Thank you. We have a long list of witnesses here. I'll just go through them in the order they were signed up on. We have a three-minute rule here. We'll try to hold you to it, and you know the rules about not reading verbatim your written material. So, Richard Kreitzer.
Mr. Chair, and
yes.
Mike, one of the things along, several of us could come up together because we are
a legislature. I appreciate that.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Richard Kreitzer. I'm the Marion County Assessor and Tax Collector. I would like to state that there are currently 6 appointed assessors and 30 elected assessors in the state of Oregon. Since the Oregon State Association of County Assessors includes all 36 county assessors, the Assessors Association does not currently take an official stand on this bill. However, I have heard from the majority of the 30 elected assessors, and I was planning on giving some feedback on each one of those. I have 17 of them, but I guess I'm limited to a three-minute time span here, so I won't do that, but they're all against this bill. I'd like to make a few comments and questions of my own about this bill. I'll start by saying that I'm a bit puzzled as to why this bill comes up every so often when each county already has a process to make elected officials appointed if they so choose. I really don't feel that this testimony is necessary because we already have that process known as home rule. The main question I have is why this bill only addresses assessors and surveyors. Why not clerks, treasurers, the sheriff, district attorney, and judges? And I didn't have that amendment either, but the bill mandates that the appointed assessors has to live in the county that they work in. What about appointed department heads in health, children and family services, finance, business services, IT, juvenile, public works, and the surveyor's office? Also, if I'm reading this bill correctly, the appointed assessor would be on a 4-year term just as if he was elected. If so, this would be the only position that I'm aware of in the county, city, or even the state of Oregon that is appointed only for 4 years. If I were appointed, I would have to report to only 3 bosses. Right now, I answer to all the voters of Marion County and all the districts. How could I feel comfortable treating everyone fairly and equitable in all circumstances if I had to first please only three people who may not all agree? As an elected assessor, I report 429 active taxing districts in Marion County. Marion County is only one of those districts. Less than 17% of the property taxes collected go to the county in Marion County, and the money goes to the general fund. As you well know, there are the school districts, the cities, the fire departments, parks and recreation, transit districts, urban renewal districts, all the various lighting districts, and the list goes on and on. Right now, I feel the process works great in keeping a clear disconnect between the revenue collectors and the people spending the money. Over the 21 years I've spent involved in the Oregon property tax system, I've heard this and similar statements many times. You just raise my taxes because you need more money, or the county needs more money so that they can pay for more pet projects. Right now, I can explain the disconnect I have as an elected official between the revenues and the expenses. I'm not so sure I'd be able to do that if I was an appointed department head.
Mr. Kreitzer, you have 3 minutes. Thank you. Before we take questions, we'll just go through the whole panel. So if we'd like to go next and read your name, start with your name.
Chairman Haas, members of the committee, my name's Bob Vroman. I'm the assessor for Clackamas County. And I will try not to go over some of the points that Mr. Kreitzer has already raised. I've had the opportunity to work with assessors, both elected and appointed. They work hard. They're dedicated. And they certainly are in the pursuit of fairness and efficiency in the administration of both Oregon's property tax system and county tax assessments. You may have already heard or read in the bill, assessors do need to meet professional and educational and experience requirements in order to qualify for the position, so I don't think that that should be an issue. This position is already nonpartisan. I think that goes a long way to being inclusive, certainly to the voting public. And as Mr. Kreitzer mentioned, there is already a process in law, the home rule process, where voters can decide if they want to appoint or elect an assessor or other elected positions. Now, it's certainly arguable that appointing assessor may take some of the politics out of the assessor's position. Certainly, having to run a campaign, having to raise money, isn't always the most desirable way to spend time. But it also gives you an opportunity to actually get out there and meet the voters and meet the people that are in your jurisdiction. removing the right to choose from the citizens, however, from those very people that we actually determine assessments for and calculate taxes for may certainly leave the perception that their right to redress their tax grievances insofar as the assessor would not any longer be directly responsible to the voters if he were appointed, may certainly give the impression or perception that he may be less responsive to public concerns and certainly more beholden to the people that appoint them. Finally, we take an oath of office just as you do, where we solemnly swear to support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon and faithfully perform our duties according to law. And we take that very seriously. In the testimony that you heard prior to ours, the factor of accountability was raised, and I would suggest to you that there's no greater accountability than to the public that actually votes you into office when you are an elected official. And I would ask you that you leave the choice in the hands of the taxpaying voters, who really should retain their right to select and elect a county assessor if they so choose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Chairman Haas and committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the assessor, elected assessor in Polk County. And I'm not going to repeat what was said, but there is a mechanism to remove someone from office if they are not doing their job, and that is the same as you, where the public votes you out. If you are not doing a job, your job as the elected assessor, then you can be voted out. So there is a mechanism. And there is also the mechanism for the counties to determine if they want to have an appointed assessor and surveyor or not, and that is home rule. And the public in that county can do that. We have multiple people that we are responsible for, not only the taxpayers of the county, which we heard a problem in one of the counties that the person didn't believe they got the relief that they should have, but we are also responsible to the districts to levy taxes and set value for those districts to operate. And we try and do that in the what the law says. And we do that without the pressure or the recommendations of the commissioners. We follow the law. And we have that responsibility to do that to both the taxpayer and the districts. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I want to say first that the debate over this issue is not at all about the quality of performance of the assessors in the state. My experience in 10 years at legislature has been when the assessors have come forward in the revenue committee, they were always excellent. Okay, and so this is no reflection on you. I think what we're looking at is a change in policy that is about the philosophy of what voters are supposed to do in a campaign here. For example, Mr. Brumman, you mentioned you have to campaign and raise money and get out and talk to people. And I, you know, with surveyors or with assessors, what are those kinds of campaign issues in which normal people, you know, understand and can make an intelligent decision?
Chairman Haas, members of the committee, I think over the past year and a half, Oregon's property tax system has maybe been the most studied that I can remember in the almost 24 years that I've been involved in assessment and taxation. Part of what I've done, and I think part of what many assessors do, is take the opportunity to actually outreach to the constituents in our jurisdictions and address and help people to understand the property tax system, one that I think could easily be described today as not very well understood. And all you have to do is look at the amount of statutory regulation that we're actually required to follow, not only in the assessment of property, but when it comes to the special assessment, exemptions, and all of the part of process that goes along in arriving at value, collecting information from taxing districts, making sure that those levies are appropriately calculated into taxes, and then mailing those tax statements and explaining those tax statements and tax amounts to the public is where we spend a lot of time, and I think it takes the expertise as well as that ability to get out and work with the public and outreach to the public and help them better not only to understand, but when they question, to show where they can take steps to probably make a difference.
Except my question was, what do you talk to them about? What do you campaign on when you send out flyers or go door-to-door, however you campaign? What are the issues that you hold out to them in which they could make an intelligent choice in this office?
Well, I think that again, everyone finds property taxes very important in their lives. And so how we administer the duties that we do, how we arrive at valuation, how taxes are actually calculated, you know, what remedies people have when they are unhappy with you know, a statement that's been set to them.
Well, when you say how we administer, I mean, you're kind of speaking to this bill, that it is more administrative. And when you say calculate taxes, those are management and administration functions. If I could push back on your answer there, that it's difficult for voters to pick intelligently a good surveyor or a good assessor based on some of the arcane things that you gentlemen understand so well. And that, I think, is sort of the bedrock of considering this. Any questions?
Just a brief one, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here. And I applaud the importance of your recognition of the importance of outreach and getting out and talking to the community. But is there anything in this bill that would prohibit an appointed assessor from doing that?
Chairman Haas, Senator Bonamici, specifically, this bill wouldn't limit an appointed assessor's opportunity to go out there. The question would be whether or not he feels the same obligation or whether or not he's received the same direction that he might, get from a county board of commissioners as opposed to what he might choose to do as an elected official. As an elected official in my county, I've chosen to do town hall meetings, to go out and actually address the public and address their questions, slightly before, and then after they receive tax statements, as an example. And I also take every other opportunity that I can in order to, actually go out and explain not only the importance of what we do insofar as what these monies go for, what services they support, because those are important matters to the taxpayers as well. So, no, there's nothing in the bill that would prevent an appointed assessor from doing that. But I'm not sure that the perception would be there from the public that someone that's appointed as opposed to someone that they have elected will do those types of things.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just a curiosity. In my times of running for office, which have been several at this point in time, I'm trying to remember a time when either the assessor's race or the surveyor's race was an opposed race. And I don't know if that's unique or not. How many times have you had opposition?
Senator Haas, Senator Cruz, I ran for election for the first time 2.5 years ago, and actually you have two of the members of this panel right here that ran against each other. There were four in Marion County 2.5 years ago in the primaries.
But that was that for an open seat?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
Did you have a debate? Because I don't even know if I can imagine.
We went through a number of months of debate.
Several debates, multiple town halls. Excuse me, Chairman, Senator Haas. So I apologize.
Okay.
But, yes, we did.
Well, thank you guys for coming up. Appreciate it. Dan Linscheid. Sorry about the pronunciation.
Senator Haas, committee members, Dan Linscheid from Sheridan, Oregon, Yamhill County Surveyor. I was appointed as in a surveying position for Yamhill County for 23 years before I was elected in 1994, and that was a contested race, but be that as it may. I did not offer this up through either Senator George's mother or himself, either way. I didn't do that. I do like the bill. There are some things I like about it, and I understand it's very contentious. It seems to me like it's good government. It gives more options to the county commissioners. In speaking with Senator George about it after I saw it rise up over here, I called him and talked to to him and his staff member about the fact that this, as at least the way I've got it, I haven't seen the Dash 1 amendment, but it looks like the one that is published is, it would be arbitrary. And that is to say that, you know, it's under, on line 17, number 2, it says, unless a county charter provides otherwise. And I would suggest to you that this might be a little bit more, or a little bit less contentious if it had the words between charter and provides, the words or ordinance, because charter refers to home rule charter counties, I believe. That's just my belief. And so if it just said, unless a county charter or ordinance provides otherwise, and that just gives more options to general law counties. So that's my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Questions, panel? So you've gone through both sides. You've been appointed and elected, and from where you see things in Yamhill County, it makes sense. The appointment system makes more sense.
Senator Hawes, it certainly does to me.
Okay, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chuck Pearson and Sean Fidler.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. I'm Chuck Pearson. I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors, who, with the exception of Mr. Lynchheit, has voted unanimously to oppose this bill. I can only speak to the surveying part of it. I am not here in an official capacity as a county surveyor. I have been an appointed county surveyor. I have been an elected county surveyor, and I am now an appointed county surveyor. Given my wishes, there's not a chance in the world that I would want to be an appointed county surveyor versus an elected county surveyor. The reasons are many. Mostly, as an appointed county surveyor, you are subject to pressure from other people in county government that are above you, that are often dealing with political favors or political whims of developers that want to have their project move to the forefront. I've been very fortunate that I've usually been able to be strong enough to explain why we can't do things like that.
Do you have some cases on that, or do you have some data or to substantiate?
Just from my own experiences, yes. There's been many times that I have been asked to move a project from number 40 in the queue list to number 1, and I would merely explain the financial impact to the rest of the developers that causes, and also that I would just love to give whoever's proposing this their phone number out to the other 40 developers and let them talk to them and explain why. Usually it works itself out. The thing about county surveyors is that there is already a statutory provision for the Board of County Commissioners to draft an ordinance, refer it to the voters for approval to make the county surveyor appointed. I only know of one case in Oregon out of several times that it's been done, that this has passed. That's in Clackamas County. I supported that at the time. Now I don't think I would. There's too many property rights. There's too many boundary disputes. There are too many neighbor-to-neighbor issues that really should not reach the realm of politics. They should stay with the people that know how to do this. Granted, you can appoint excellent county surveyors and excellent county assessors, but my major point is, why are we doing this? Where is the public outcry to do this? Have your constituents come to you and said, we need to change this, or is this for some other reason? I've heard testimony earlier that cited home rule charters. We can certainly do that. We could certainly pass a law to allow the counties, if they wanted to refer something to the voters. Clackamas County, I believe it failed twice before the last time. And one of the reasons it passed is because I did support it. in retrospect, I wish I was still elected. I liked being elected, and I liked the responsibility and the ability to talk to the people that elected me when they had a problem and try and fix their problem for them. So in many of the Eastern Oregon counties, we have, through this association, made a special effort to make sure there was a county surveyor in every county. In many of the Eastern Oregon counties, there were years that there were no county surveyors. And what happens to the public records that are in there in one county, I don't even remember, Wheeler County, all of the surveys and the plats were put in a box and filed, not filed, they were set in the corner of the county clerk's office and they're safe. This is not good management of public records, and this is just not a bill that I feel is in the interest of the public. Let the voters decide whether they want to elect or appoint their county surveyor. Let's not do it at the state level. Thank you. And I have with me Sean Fiddler, who's representing the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. He's from Gresham, I believe, and would like to talk to you.
Okay.
Senator Hawes.
Before you start, we have 36 counties. How many have elected surveyors?
I believe that the number is about 23 or 4 are elected county surveyors.
Okay.
Mostly the home rule charters, with the exception of Clackamas County, that's not a home rule charter. Jackson County is a home rule charter. They elected or decided to maintain the election of their officers.
Okay. Mr. Fiddler?
Senator Hawes and the committee, I apologize if I don't perfectly formal. This is my first time ever being in front of a board. My name is Sean Fiddler. I'm a professional land surveyor, and I do live in Gresham. I'm also the Pioneer Chapter President of the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon this year. And at our recent meeting, we have discussed this bill, and there's an overwhelming amount that is opposed to this bill. If it's not broke, why fix it? We also, throughout the past week, we have had amount going through the website of discussion on this, and that is the majority. The Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon, we have about 800 members, and we are very concerned about the fact that there might not be even a county surveyor in some of the more rural counties in the eastern side of the state to protect the maps. You know, today is President's Day, and all I can think of is, you know, three of our presidents that are on Mount Rushmore were land surveyors. And it just, you know, they took the time to take care of the maps and to establish this country. And I think it's important that we just leave that to the voters. And that is all I have to say. So it's short and sweet. But we oppose it as a professional land surveyors board. We oppose it very much. So any questions?
I appreciate that. Maybe one of you could answer this. When getting back to the campaigning of these jobs, when it comes to surveyors, who contributes to your campaigns? Just average people? Is it developers? Is it builders? Is it other surveyors?
Senator Chair Haas, members of the committee, when I ran for my elected position, I had private surveyors. I had citizens that contributed to my campaign. I think the largest campaign contribution I had was $500, which I returned because I didn't want to be beholden to a large development company.
I think you're speaking to the point of my question was,
yes.
I think somebody, you mentioned the pressure from developers and that sort of thing. I would think that because of the kind of apparatus that we have at campaigns and fundraising, that there may be some unintended pressures there from the developer that you're talking about, other surveyors, and they're just, it feels like there's a separate set of pressures that would not be in the public's best interest.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, whether you're elected or appointed, those pressures are still going to be there. I am not so much in this particular economy, but before this, I would be besieged by every sob story in the world. You could hear why a development should go forth before anybody else. We have a first-in, first-out policy, and the only time I've ever bowed to something was the Sisters of St. Mary, and they presented a very compelling argument. I had the flu, and they said they'd pray for me.
I don't know There's an ethics charge. All right. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Senator Bonamici was okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question to hopefully to clarify the record, because in Mr. Pearson, in your letter, you suggest that should the position be required to be appointed, there's a danger that some counties would not appoint because of the budgetary restraints. And maybe our committee administrator can answer the question. The way I'm looking at the bill, it says, unless the county charter provides otherwise, the governing body of a county shall appoint. So it doesn't sound like it's a discretionary act on the part of the county that they do need to, under the terms of this bill, appoint someone. Is that correct?
That's my understanding as well, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you.
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, if I may, I understand, and I haven't seen them either, that the -1 amendments would remove the word charter, which would give the bill an entirely different meaning, and then it would be at the option of the county. I believe it would read, unless a county provides otherwise. So the county could make the determination by resolution and order by ordinance or whatever. But I haven't seen the -1s.
Neither have we. So thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a slight bit of confusion. A survey is a survey. So you weren't talking about, you're talking about pressure, but it's just a place in the queue because a survey is a survey. The pressure can't make you move a line. The line's where it is. So, correct? You're just talking about pressure to move into the priority list, and that was it?
Chair Oz, Senator Cruz, that is mostly the pressure that comes from developers that have gone through this huge planning process that can sometimes take 2 years, and they get to the caboose, which is the county surveyor, and then they want their development approved. Now they've got hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars worth of infrastructure in the ground. They need to move forward.
Mr. Chair, I'd suggest that speaks to problems in the development process as well. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And I want to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 344. Committee, we have one, maybe two housekeeping bills that I think we could dispense with pretty quickly. So let me open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 120. Vicki Chamberlain is here to help us go through these. Dana, if you could give us a quick summary on 120.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 120 modifies the requirements related to first aid cards in schools to reflect the change in law that no longer requires a first aid card for a teaching license that declares emergency when take effect upon passage.
Okay. Chamberlain.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Committee. And shall I just take them in order?
Sure.
Senate Bill 119 is...
Oh, no. 120. I'm sorry. I thought you meant sections.
Senate Bill 120 is just a housekeeping bill that cleans up a statute when the legislature repealed the requirement that we require a first aid card. This statute was sort of connected, and all this does is take out the reference to TSBC requiring the first aid card.
Makes perfect sense to me, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? No one else has signed up? I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 120.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 120 be referred to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves that Senate Bill 120 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendations. Recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. Senator Metzger is excused. Senate Bill 119 feels a little more involved.
Carry on that one real quick, Mr. Chair.
I think it's my turn, so I will do that. We'll put up a public hearing on Senate Bill 119. Ms. Chamberlain?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Vicki Chamberlain again, TSPC. This bill is asking for a somewhat major amendment. Years ago when the TSPC statutes were carved out of ODE, one of the things that remained was that TSPC was required to suspend the license of a teacher who did not give a district 60 days notice before they resigned. And this has been a little bit of a problematic statute. We tried to have it repealed because we thought it ought to be a contract issue or an employment issue in 2005, and OSBA's opposition to that sort of resulted in some amendments, which became a little bit more workable. And the reason is this, is when the TSPC was required to take its hearings to the Office of Administrative Hearings, what we were finding back then was that by the time these things got to hearing, the school year had expired, which made the statute fundamentally obsolete and sort of created an unnecessary cost. So the amendments allow TSPC to hear these now, and these are not very complex cases, and they often look very much alike. So what I gave you was sort of a bulleted scenario of usually what happens is that the educator does not give sufficient notice, in other words, the 60-day notice, and the district also does not at that time remind the educator that if they don't give the 60-day notice, that they could have their license suspended. And then the educator gets a job in another district, and the district comes to TSPC asking us to suspend the license. We will get that information somewhere between November and February. Well, the commission has a January, March, May, or February, April-ish meeting schedule. So the commission will have the hearing. We'll get all of this information. But by the time the commission has the hearing in the spring, this educator's been in a new job now for about 7 months. And the newly employing school district is saying it would be an extreme hardship if this person is pulled out of the classroom after having been there in the new job for 7 months. So the commission sees sort of both sides had a role in how this ended up. And so what the commission is asking is that if the legislature is going to require the commission to continue to look at these cases, that they be that the commission have a little bit more flexibility to do something like reprimand people or something like that. They've seen a few cases where they would do that, where there was one case where somebody sent less than 24-hour notice on a Sunday night that they wouldn't be there Monday morning, and because they wanted to go on a vacation. Now, that's really putting the district in a bad position. Again, most people think it ought to be a contract issue, but if it's in our shop, the commission would look at that and think that that is not good professional conduct. This would just take this out of the having to do something by the end of the school year, having to suspend, because I don't think the commission suspended the license of one person out of about 8 cases in the last 5 years because it was something egregious like the one I told you, where the person really left the district in a hardship, just got up in the middle of the day and walked out, and the commission did suspend their license. So this just takes out the you must suspend and you must suspend for the rest of the school year and allows the commission to consider all the facts and say, no, there's nothing here, or maybe that rises to the level of a reprimand or a probation or whatever. So the facts are so variable that that's what this bill is asking.
Okay. I could see this problem. You're saying it's about happens a couple times a year. Questions?
I have a question.
Senator Bonamici?
Mr. Chair, is anyone opposing this? It seems logical to me.
Seems, Mr. Chair, it seems like an improvement
over
where we currently stand, for sure.
So has anyone else signed up?
No one else has signed up. If someone does give a notice, maybe verbal or telephone call, properly, the district changes its administrative staff and doesn't get word, what is the recourse for this person who might be up for misconduct charges the following year?
I think I understand your question. The only way we can get the case is if the district formally refers it to us. And our procedure is they have to actually go to their school board and get a resolution to do that because we didn't want people doing it without their school board knowing that they were forwarding people. So the commission has actually not taken action because they thought there was behavior that it just didn't rise to the level of having the to suspend the license. So, in fact, the commission did not take any action in two of the last three cases they saw based on all the facts. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, Vicki, is the school district required to report this? For example, I'm teaching in Salem, and I get notice this evening that my father, who lives in L.A., has died of a heart attack, and my blind mother has nobody to take care of her because I'm an only child, and I've got to leave. And so, obviously, I'm going to have to resign my position. So the only ones you get reported to you are the ones that the district has issue with. Is that correct? So a case like mine, they'd say, nothing we can do, and you never hear about that. Is that correct?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, that's absolutely correct. In fact, most districts don't refer these cases. And most educators and administrators work that out, work something like that out. The something that would be mitigating, though, would be is if the district had two or three resignations and only referred one to us. You see, it's very, very arbitrary about whether we will ever get any of these cases. But that's why we wanted to repeal it. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay. Bruce?
No, I'm good.
Committee, I guess I'm willing if you are. All right. Close a hearing on Senate Bill 119 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 119.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
I just want to clarify something.
Senator Bonnie.
Thank you. Because I just noticed this in the summary. Is this changing who does the deliberation? Because it says provides that hearing related to discipline be conducted by administrative law judge. Are they not now?
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, no. Right now, the commission hears these cases directly. They're the only cases that that commission actually does hear directly. And we conduct a formal hearing. We allow them to testify. We allow them to bring witnesses. The commission used to do this all the time before the Office of Administrative Hearings. This allowed us to get them in, get a decision on it more quickly than referring it to the Office of Administrative Hearings. This puts this bill would put these cases in line with all the rest of the conduct cases we have to consider, so that the educator, if the commission decided that there appeared to be cause to charge them with a violation, that they could ask for a hearing in front of the Office of Administrative Hearings. But it.
Further discussion? Seeing none, any objections to Senate Bill 119? Seeing none, Senate Bill 119 passes. Senator Morris, would you mind carrying this bill?
I would be delighted.
And colleagues, the quickest of these three is Senate Bill 121, I'm guessing. So we'll I'll open up a public hearing.
I've got a lot of questions.
Bill 121.
Long line of witnesses.
We've let Vicki off way too easy today.
So. That's true.
I had a feeling it was coming. Chair Haas, member of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, TSPC. This bill looks a little busier than it would, only because Legislative Council has done a great job of weeding out some really old language like thereofs and other things like that. The thing that we asked for was subsection 2 on line 12, and that is the legislature has required TSPC for a number of years to require knowledge of civil rights laws or anti-discrimination laws, and I think when this was enacted in the 70s, it was intended to get to the heart of not having educators discriminate against children, and which is a great idea. The commission sees that also as an ethical duty. And given some of the issues that we've dealt with this session and during the interim, we would be the first state in the nation to require knowledge of our ethical standards of professional conduct for educators prior to licensure. So the commission actually, your staff asked us, do we need this? No, we do not. We have put together a test, which I gave you a copy of, just a sample test of how the new test would look like. And that was this right here. The answers are on the back if you want to take it and see how you would do. But it just calls to the attention that we have a job to be equitable in how we treat all children, and I think we all know that that's really at the heart of No Child Left Behind, too, is that all children succeed. And just in case you hadn't seen them in a while, I attached the ethical standards of conduct and so that you can see them. It contains the crimes for which we're required to revoke licenses, as well as other expectations for educator behavior while on the job and off the job. So the commission is asking the legislature's permission to add the ethical requirements so that future commissions would also make sure that that happens.
Thank you. Would that lengthen the test, if you will, or would that replace something?
No, we already put some in there. There's a couple of questions in there in the test already. That's what I'm saying. We really don't need legislation to do this. The commission, you've given the commission the authority to set the standards for licensure, and this commission has decided it should be incorporated as part of the civil rights knowledge. So there's just a couple of ethical questions in this test. It's not a high-stakes test. It's intended to be...
Just raise awareness.
Precisely.
Okay.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Some more?
Would the ethical questions focus on the section of 584-020-0035?
Yes. Actually, primarily 35 and 40. 35 has the exploiting professional relationships and other things like that. And then if you switch over, 40 has the real centerpiece of this, starts on page 11 of 14. So knowing and substantial unauthorized use of school property, knowing and substantial unauthorized use of employment time, falsifying documents, misrepresentation, unreasonable force against students, et cetera, you can see that the list is fairly precise and objective, so that it was critical that we have some kind of objective criteria for answers.
And you're doing this now.
We're implementing it. We're implementing the test, right, the test. And it has, I think, three items on it, or no more than four items related to ethics, related to knowledge of ethics. Then the this is on the website for people to study. There are no surprises. The rules are on the website for people to study. So actually the score setting for this test is going to happen this week, and the commission has not yet adopted a passing score.
Okay. I think I see this, that you're implementing this now, but putting this in law would raise the awareness and ethical standards, particularly in light of what's gone on the last year or two.
Correct.
So I'm going to close a hearing on Senate Bill 121 and open a work session on Senate Bill 121.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 121 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves for Senate Bill 121 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections to Senate Bill 121? Seeing none. So ordered. Senate Bill 121 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Next on the list is Senator Bonamici. Would you carry this bill, please?
I would. Thank you.
Thank you, committee.
Work session.
We're almost there. Let me open a work session for the purposes of introduction of committee measures.
Okay, we do have an LC in front of us relating to education service districts that I sent out on Friday.
Do we have a number? Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2788 dated 2-13-09 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Morris moves that LC 2788 dated 2-13-09 be introduced as a committee bill. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how excited I am about this, but I won't stand in the way of the introduction.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. And as a reminder, support for the introduction and concept does not imply support for the opposition once this is introduced. Further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none? So ordered. And with that, committee, we are adjourned.
I think we got through all that.
Yeah.